You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Leningrad is Calling by Willem Marx. In the early years of Putin's reign, the threat perhaps didn't feel like one. Tony Blair's government even loosened the threshold for these foreign investors further, allowing them to use borrowed money. Russians applying from outside the country were granted visas in larger numbers than any other nationality within a few years of that change. In August 2008, one of Blair's closest advisors, Peter Mandelson, accepted an invitation from Deripaska to visit his magnificent 238-foot yacht, the Queen Kay, now known as Cleo, freshly refurbished and anchored off the coast of Corfu. By then, Mandelson had been forced twice out of Blair's cabinet. The first time, after accepting a secret loan from a colleague, and later, amid allegations, he had supported the UK passport application of an Indian billionaire in a convoluted quid pro quo. Though a subsequent inquiry found Mandelson had wielded no improper pressure. Nothing, if not a survivor, he was named to Parliament's unelected upper chamber, the House of Lords, as Baron Mandelson of Foy in the county of Herefordshire and Hartlepool in the county of Durham. He's publicly insisted on plain old Lord Mandelson. Back in 2008, he was the European Trade Commissioner, making decisions about the bloc's tariffs on imported materials, such as aluminum. That rendered his choice to spend time on the Queen Kay of natural interest to Britain's political press. His spokesman explained his presence by saying the two men had been on holiday in the same area and it was purely a social occasion. As Mandelson yacht sprawled in Greece, a close friend of future Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron also came aboard the Queen Kay. It was one of four encounters over several days between Deripaska and George Osborne, a striver born to become the 18th Baronet of Ballantaylor and Ballylimmon, and later Britain's finance minister from 2010 to 2016. He was accompanied by yet another Cameron friend, Andrew Feldman, at the time the chief executive of the Conservative Party and chief fundraiser. The social maven behind this slightly surprising menage was the future Baron Rothschild, Nathaniel, himself a pal of Osborne's from their Oxford days, who had reportedly run out of space for Mandelson in his family villa, and so billeted him on the Russian's yacht. Incensed by the media reports of Mandelson's presence on the yacht, for which he appeared to fault Osborne, Rothschild wrote a detailed letter to the London Times alleging that Osborne and Feldman had boarded the boat to solicit a donation from Deripaska. Rothschild noted that, following the meeting, Feldman had suggested, since the magnate was not a British citizen, any political donation would need to be channeled through one of Mr. Deripaska's British companies, which would have been illegal. The Conservative Party defended Feldman, stating he had not met Deripaska previously and was not aware who he was. It added that there was no discussion about how a donation could be channeled. Rather, Feldman gave his regular explanation of UK trading companies making political donations. It would be better, Rothschild concluded, in a shot across Osborne's bow, if all involved accepted the age-old adage that private parties are just that. Osborne insisted no further action had been pursued. The Prime Minister at the time, Gordon Brown, then no friend of Mandelson's, said the episode demanded investigation. But Cameron stood behind Osborne. Like Johnson and Rothschild, both had belonged to Oxford University's Bullingdon Club. Photographs of them dressed in the society's $1,000 bespoke tailcoats combined with the tableau of a Russian-owned mega-yacht to permanently stain Osborne's political reputation. Although Deripaska's political donations may have ultimately proven unpalatable, another member of Cameron and Osborne's conservative cabinet was later happy to accept multi-million-dollar paychecks from the aluminum czar. Greg Barker, also known as the Right Honorable, the Lord Barker of Battle, or Baron Barker, ever since Cameron rewarded his loyalty with a lifetime sinecure in the House of Lords, has worked with Russian businesses and billionaires off and on for decades. In 2017, he took on the independent chairmanship of Deripaska's company, N&Group Group, before its founder was placed under U.S. sanctions. In 2019, he became executive chairman and only resigned amid the furor following the Ukraine invasion. Prior to his N&Group resignation, Barker had noted that N&Group is a very international company with a big operation in Ukraine. Whatever the optics, the fact is, I have a real responsibility for thousands of employees on the ground right now in Ukraine. I will not shirk that responsibility and walk away when there is fighting just miles from our plant there. Last year, Osborne reportedly used his relationship with Barker to win unpaid advisory work with N&Group for an investment bank, where he is now a partner. Prior to that, after stepping down as finance minister, and despite minimal journalism experience, Osborne had scored the top editorship at London's major newspaper, The Evening Standard, owned by Evgeny Lebedev, whose father had served, like Putin, in the KGB. In 2012, Lebedev's paper had supported Johnson's second term as London mayor. In 2020, Johnson nominated Lebedev for a peerage, and with the new title, a lifelong membership in the House of Lords, with its signature mix of donors, grandees, and hereditary aristocrats. Baron Lebedev of Hampton, in the London borough of Richmond upon Thames, and of Siberia, in the Russian Federation, has yet to vote or speak in a single debate. MI5 and MI6 have each reportedly raised concerns that Lebedev's participation in Parliament might constitute a security threat. As a consequence, opposition lawmakers and even some members of Johnson's own party demanded in late March that the agency's advice be declassified. Johnson's government missed the deadline, then weeks later put out a tiny smattering of largely irrelevant documents and withheld the rest from the public on grounds of national security. Lebedev, who won UK citizenship in 2010, also issued a statement in March in one of his own papers. His holdings include The Independent, too, insisting he was British to the core. "I am not a security risk to this country, which I love," he wrote. In May, the Canadian government sanctioned Lebedev's father as either a Russian oligarch or close associate of one who had directly enabled Vladimir Putin's senseless war in Ukraine. Next photos, Roman Abramovich, who sold his Chelsea football club as government scrutiny increased. Beechwood House, valued at $64 million, is the subject of a sanctions spat. Vladimir Putin speaks with Oleg Deripaska, an aluminum oligarch, at the International Investment Forum in Sochi in 2008. Funds from other Russian-born British residents turned citizens have flowed easily into conservative coffers in recent years. Lubov Chanarkin, the Russian-born wife of a former deputy finance minister and state bank chairman, Vladimir Chanarkin, has been especially generous. Among women, she is the party's second highest donor, contributing the equivalent at press time of nearly $2.7 million. For context, the Conservatives reported taking in around $22 million from publicly disclosed donors around the last general election in 2019. In 2004, Deripaska and Rothschild had helped her husband find his feet in London, where he was able to obtain a work visa. The Chanarkins eventually gained British citizenship several years later, and both Theresa May and Cameron subsequently participated in fundraising efforts that attracted her donations, which began a few years after she married Vladimir in 2007. In 2019, Liz Truss, who is now Britain's foreign secretary and has loudly trumpeted a new series of sanctions since early March, posted a picture of May and the blonde Mrs. Chanarkin, who had ponied up around $175,000 to dine with a handful of senior conservative female Poles at a hotel just a stone's throw from Buckingham Palace. Chanarkin had paid even more than that in 2014 to play tennis with Cameron and Johnson, at the time Prime Minister and London Mayor, respectively. Following Russia's annexation of Crimea, Cameron faced criticism for accepting that donation. He argued at the time that Mrs. Chanarkin, by then a British citizen, was not a crony of Putin, so keeping the donation was the right approach. Recently, Leila Moran, a lawmaker from the Liberal Democrat Opposition Party, said that decision should be reversed and all such funds returned. "It's just the right thing to do right now," she told Vanity Fair amid general criticism of these donations. Chanarkin's lawyers have repeatedly said her money has nothing to do with the Kremlin, nor is Vladimir Chanarkin linked to Putin or the Kremlin in any way. A Deutsche Bank document, known as a suspicious activity report to the U.S. Treasury, shows that a potential shell company registered in the British Virgin Islands initiated a 2016 funds transfer worth $8 million to Chanarkin's husband. According to the document, first leaked to BuzzFeed News, the BVI firm was controlled by the children of a billionaire member of the Russian parliament's upper chamber, Suleyman Karimov, who provided their funding. Deutsche Bank's risk team flagged it in the suspicious activity report, since Chanarkin was a politically exposed person and because the commercial purpose of the transactions and the relationship between the parties could not be determined. Karimov has denied any dealings with Mrs. Chanarkin. The Chanarkin's representatives said it was a short-term commercial loan that was swiftly repaid. That Mrs. Chanarkin never directly or indirectly received money from Karimov, and that donations to the Conservatives derived from her own funds. Since then, Karimov has been placed under UK and US sanctions. At press time, the feds successfully seized a $325 million yacht, believed to be his, after it was moored for months in Fiji. In a 2019 letter to Brandon Lewis, then the Conservative Party chairman, Stephen Kinnock, an opposition Labour legislator, expressed his concerns about the troubling connections to the Conservative Party's new Israeli-born treasurer, Ehud Shaleg, which appear to revolve around his business interest in Russia. He also cited Shaleg's purported contact with disreputable characters linked to Russia. He wrote that it seemed extremely important that the Conservatives examine whether or not there had been any activity that required investigation, or whether their new treasurer provides an opportunity for the Russian state, or other hostile organizations to influence the sovereignty of the Conservative Party and thereby the nation. Lewis, now the minister responsible for resolving the Gordian knot of Northern Ireland's troubled post-Brexit peace process, warned Kinnock he was risking libel with his accusations. "I do not believe Mr. Schlegg should be expected to respond to what I believe is a political fishing exercise," Lewis wrote. "Mr. Schlegg's business dealings are properly registered and declared," he added, concluding, "I hope my word will be enough to satisfy your doubts." Fast forward to May, the New York Times reported that the UK-headquartered bank Barclays had filed a suspicious activity report to the National Crime Agency, Britain's chronically underfunded version of the FBI, the year before Schlegg became party treasurer. The documents indicated that a February 2018 donation to the Conservative Party of around $630,000 made by Schlegg had originated in a Russian account belonging to his father-in-law. The Conservatives said afterward that all donations comply fully with the law. Suspicious activity reports themselves are rather routine and don't necessarily lead to further investigation. The National Crime Agency received nearly 500,000 of them between April 2018 and March 2019, of which 80% involved banks. A spokesperson for the UK's Electoral Commission said it had looked into the donation and considered whether there had been a breach of the party finance laws that it enforces. "We have no evidence that the party has committed an offence and will therefore not be investigating," she said. Around the time Theresa May resigned as Prime Minister to be replaced by Johnson, she put Schlegg forth for a knighthood. Months later, in early 2020, Sir Ehud donated more than $12,000 directly to Lewis, according to parliamentary disclosure forms. Coincidentally, Lubov Chernikin donated the same amount to him on the same date. A Lewis representative said his donations are properly and transparently declared and published, and that he's never accepted foreign donations as they are illegal. The representative added, "In terms of any rationale for specific amounts on specific dates, that question would be better directed at those who donated." Next photos, UK Transport Secretary Grant Shapps beside Pi, a 192-foot superyacht that reportedly belongs to Vitaly Vasilievich Kuchetkov and which the UK detained amid new sanctions. Kinnock told Vanity Fair he considered Lewis's letter defending Schlegg a direct and clear example of buying influence, and it had been outrageous for Lewis to warn him against asking legitimate questions. Having read details in the New York Times of the suspicious activity report submitted by Barclays Bank about the transaction, Kinnock remains frustrated by Lewis's response. "A businessman who is properly registered and declared does not receive a gift from his father-in-law." "That pings around Europe through several different bank accounts," Kinnock told Vanity Fair, "and then the next day makes a very substantial donation to the Conservative Party." A lawyer for Schlegg told The Times there was absolutely no basis for linking the funds transfer to Schlegg's political donation. "There are many people in this country of Russian origin who are British citizens," Lewis's representative told Vanity Fair. "Like any other British citizen, they have the right to donate to political parties, their representatives, and participate fully in our democracy." Late in the spring of 2014, the all-party parliamentary group on Russia gathered for its annual meeting in a small wood-paneled committee room in the Palace of Westminster. A typical RSVP would include two lords, three MPs, and a dog, says Chris Bryant, the former deputy leader of the House of Commons under the previous Labour-led government and for years an outspoken critic of the Putin government's appalling human rights record. But this meeting, which would address whether to retain or replace Bryant, then the group's chairman, was surprisingly well attended, including by Cameron and Osborne, who turned up alongside many dozens of their conservative comrades. An advocacy group of parliamentarians and political hangers-on had been gathering support in a campaign to oust Bryant. Called the Conservative Friends of Russia, it had launched itself only 2 years prior, in 2012, with a party at Russia's London embassy. Carrie Simmons, now Johnson's wife, was among the guests. "We ended up having to put somebody on the door because just so many people came through and everybody got to vote," Bryant told Vanity Fair of the parliamentary gathering. "It was just extraordinary." The Friends of Russia seemingly succeeded, and Bryant's time chairing the group came to an end, albeit temporarily, as he was reelected in 2017. Bryant now recalls a dinner event he attended a few years ago with a smattering of U.S. congressmen and Bill Browder, the financier and Kremlin critic whose lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, was murdered in 2009. Inspiring the original U.S. sanctions that would one day be placed on Putin's inner circle. Cameron was there too, he says, and approached his erstwhile opponent with a disarming comment, Bryant remembers. "I got it wrong. You were right about Russia." Johnson made a similar acknowledgement recently, parliamentary transcripts show, saying Bryant had been right for a long time on Russia, and he has been vindicated. Another minister called Bryant a dog with a bone on the issue of Russian malfeasance, but insisted the Ukraine invasion meant things had reached a turning point. Bryant isn't convinced. He also remembers how Johnson, as foreign minister, badly fumbled his first meeting with Putin's jowly top diplomat, Sergei Lavrov, as he sought to normalize relations with Moscow. "The prime minister has played Neville Chamberlain on Russia since 2014, Bryant says, in reference to the British leader who pursued a policy of appeasement with Hitler in the late 1930s. Johnson is now trying to protect leadership. He is now trying to project leadership with his rhetoric and a much ballyhooed visit to Kyiv, as if to say, let's try and pretend to be a Churchill." Johnson's office responded that he had been front and center of the international response to Putin's barbaric invasion. The UK shuttered the Golden Visa program in February. Interior Minister and Johnson ally Priti Patel said she wanted to stop corporate elites threatening Britain's national security or pushing dirty money around the UK's cities. But as Bryant points out, many of the now sanctioned individuals had by then been granted visas by the same government, even after the annexation of Crimea underlined Putin's brutal territorial ambitions. As Attorney General at the time, Dominic Grieve says he felt Britain's response to the unilateral occupation of Ukraine's Black Sea Peninsula had been inadequate and did not meet the gravity of what the Russians had actually done. Cameron replaced him without explanation months later. "The government's sudden recognition this spring was too little too late," Grieve asserts. "The fact they've had their assets seized and can't come here anymore is because the security assessment is that they pose a significant risk. They are intimately linked with the Russian leadership. Now, that was obvious before it was done." Victoria Borwick was the Conservative Member of Parliament for Kensington until 2017 and the wife of Geoffrey, the fifth Baron Borwick, one of the few remaining hereditary aristocrats left in Britain's House of Lords. She previously served as Johnson's deputy when he was London mayor and remembers endless meetings about the need for new housing and the challenges of cash-rich foreign individuals outbidding British would-be buyers. Johnson used to argue simply building more homes would solve the city's long-term housing crisis, but his team understood that approach was not a silver bullet. "We all said, okay, Boris, There's no point building all these bloody houses if we can't sell them to English people, she recalls. Wealthy overseas buyers wanted brand new, absolutely virgin residential properties and had the cash to put down immediately, Borwick explains. As a developer, why not take the money? Proving Russian ownership of a London home is not always easy, never mind taking the legally binding action to seize such assets. The advocacy group Transparency International UK recently published an analysis of open source data, including property ownership and court records, leaked information, and journalist investigations that shows around $2 billion worth of UK property has been purchased by Russians who either have links to the Kremlin or are accused of corruption. The majority of the properties are in just three central London neighborhoods, including the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea. When people talk about it as being one of the world's major money laundering hubs, I think that's quite right, says Duncan Hames, who heads policy and programs for the UK arm of the organization. This whole anonymous ownership problem would have fundamentally undermined the sanctions, which the Foreign Secretary is particularly proud of. Various data leaks in recent years have been crucial for NGOs seeking to shine a light. And while admittedly British businesses that serviced Russian wealth, banks, accountants, lawyers, and real estate agents, seemed for a long time to have jettisoned their scruples, without better public information, it will be difficult for such London service firms to avoid inadvertently befalling afoul of sanctions in future, and that may in turn rely on those that understand such bad behavior best, other outraged Russians. Like Roman Borisovich, a blonde, barrel-chested Columbia University grad who's worked as a senior trader at Merrill Lynch and an investment banker at Deutsche Bank. Raised in Moscow by Russian and Ukrainian parents, he returned to the Russian capital to help run a struggling Soviet-era insurance behemoth and became an early supporter of Alexei Navalny's anti-corruption foundation. Around the time Borisovich's wife was held for an extended period at a Moscow airport while returning from a European vacation in 2012, Navalny cautioned him that he might face Kremlin accusations of spying for Western governments. The banker moved his family right back to London, where they subsequently lived for several years. On their hunt for a new apartment there, a young punk of a real estate broker provoked his ire during a tour of a penthouse duplex next to Dormition Cathedral, seat of the UK's Russian Orthodox Diocese. He was trying to endear himself by saying that his firm deals with Russians all the time, Borisovich recalls of the broker, who told him they had recently sold a $32 million property to one of Russia's regional governors. That's when I looked at him. Would you be saying the same if this was a Mexican drug dealer? Would you be telling people with the same sort of pride that you've done it? The broker went quiet as Borisovich railed about how local officials in Russia were not paid nearly enough, at least not by honest means, to buy an apartment in Knightsbridge, where the most recent data puts average real estate transactions around $4 million. Since that encounter, he has lobbied for transparency. Corruption, Borisovich says, is the cement, and this is the concrete of the foundation of Russia's current government. There is nothing else that holds it together. It has the power to metastasize. The less probity or propriety we have in our system, the more open we are to manipulation and exploitation by ruthless or authoritarian regimes like the one we see in the Kremlin, says Kinnock, who spent several years living in Russia during the mid-2000s. New rules he and others are advocating for would follow a U.S.-style registry of foreign agents and empower independent forensic accountants to perform due diligence on all party donors. We can actually then start to clean up our politics and to protect the integrity of our democracy. Open Road, she helped impeach Donald Trump and survived an insurrection. Now, Val Demings is setting her eyes on the Senate. Can the former police chief convince Floridians she's the right woman for the job? By Rita Omoka, with photographs by Annie Leibovitz. Opening photo, Driving Ambition, On her red Harley Davidson, Representative Val Demings makes her way across Florida with an eye to the midterms. There was sure to be drama at the Lake County campaign stop. That's expected for any Democrat entering a rural Florida town that went to Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020, let alone a black woman. It was a hot spring morning. The pine trees were full, the sky clear, and Representative Val Demings pulled up on her red Harley Davidson with her biker crew, 30 deep, engines revving. People stared. Some stuck out phones. This was her first of four drop-ins to local eateries in the county, a tiny Cracker Barrel-type spot with cream-stained walls and the smell of fried butter and syrup. The goal that Saturday was to do the stops in about 3 hours, a bite here, a sip there, and selfies everywhere. Demings' staffers hustled into the red bungalow, scurrying to keep her on time. Since breaking day at Ace Cafe, 27 miles away in her 10th congressional district, where her pack of motorcyclists, ex-Air Force, military, law enforcement, first congregated, her campaign staff of millennials and Gen Zers had worried the crammed day would veer off schedule. They'd come to appreciate and plan around Demings' penchant for zingers and lingering conversations. Geared up in a Harley pink-striped button-down, blue jeans, and fingerless gloves, Demings milled about with twinkling eyes. Mostly white customers filled the space. They stared and flashed reflexive smiles. She announced to each table that she's running for Senate to unseat Marco Rubio, her voice crisp and measured. When she stopped to greet the only black family in the place, a father with his two young sons, the man smiled and quietly told her he knew her well. As Demings worked her way out the diner, a white man with sparse grays and a stubbly beard grabbed her right hand. "Miss Demings," he said, locking eyes. "Yes." Her staffer stood more erect. "I want to ask you," the man began. More stares. "Can I pray for you?" the man asked, his voice soft, his gaze on Demings as he cradled her hands. Her staffer's shoulders dropped in relief. In a town where Confederate flags fly freely, in a state that increasingly restricts LGBTQ+, reproductive and voting rights, and bans history books, while its Republican officials call a mob attack on the Capitol legitimate political discourse, their fear of the worst-case scenario was no exaggeration. Eyes tightly shut, head bowed, the man prayed. "God, I ask that you watch over Miss Demings as she rides her motorcycle, that you keep your hand of protection on her, guide her and encourage her. We bless your name. In Jesus' name, amen." Later that afternoon, at another eatery where a crescendo of Senator Val chants greeted her, Demings dwelled on that encounter as she debriefed with one of her staffers over burgers and fries. She reflected on how stereotypes can creep in unexpectedly, even when we know better. "What I felt, it wasn't him, it was me," she said. "When the man reached for her, where I was flashed through my head, and I looked at him and thought about the people that broke into the Capitol." Demings has been guided by that same earnest self-checking she's exerted at campaign stops since entering Congress 5 years ago. She went from upholding the law as a police officer at every rank for 27 years to crafting it, first taking the oath on January 3, 2017, 17 days before Trump was sworn in. "I went to his inauguration," Demings told me. "Even though I didn't vote for him, he was still our president." As he governed, she found one of Trump's shortcomings was that he never understood the oath he took, our democracy, the Constitution, the rule of law, and therefore he didn't protect it, and it showed. 8 years before that swearing in, Demings was chief of the Orlando Police Department, when a man entered a downtown office tower and began firing a handgun, injuring five people and killing one. The November 6, 2009 shooting made national headlines. Her handling of the case is what her husband, Jerry, a former Orlando police chief, believes caught the attention of the National Democratic Party. Because afterward, the couple was invited to D.C. to meet with its leaders, including then-Vice President Joe Biden and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Jerry told me the meeting felt like recruitment for future party leaders. He sensed they were somewhat strategic in identifying the talent to replace them. They want authentic individuals who have intellectual abilities, the charisma, to be able to do the job. And because, I mean, they are all 80-plus years old, so they got to fold it soon. Demings announced her retirement from the police force in May 2011, and in July, her plans to unseat first-term Republican Congressman Daniel Webster. She narrowly lost to Webster, then ran for mayor of Orange County in 2014, but dropped out because she felt it wasn't the right race for her. She had actually been underperforming in polling and fundraising to the popular incumbent. When Florida's 10th district was redrawn, Demings ran and won. She emerged in the party as someone who can speak about systemic racism and police brutality while insulating Democrats from GOP charges that they are soft on crime or hold extreme progressive ideologies. Heading into the midterms, Demings provides Democrats a big-name candidate in their hopes to hold on to the Senate. The 65-year-old three-term moderate has appeared uninterested in upending the system, so there's no worry of her being caricatured as a leftist or a socialist bearing woke ideals as she runs in a bastion of Republican conservatism. With her consistent track record in policy and tone, you never have to worry where she stands on an issue. Representative David Cicilline, who serves on the House Judiciary Committee alongside Demings, told me, she has a set of life experiences that give her incredible credibility. As a member of the Intelligence and Judiciary Committees, the bodies with jurisdiction over impeachment inquiries, Demings was part of the team responsible for gathering intel for the first Trump trial. While several colleagues submitted their names to Pelosi for an impeachment manager role, Demings didn't. It wasn't that she doubted herself or her abilities. Far from it. Her ego is healthy, she told me, but she thought about the two previous impeachment trials, Bill Clinton's and Andrew Johnson's. Those managers were white men and all attorneys. Sometimes we get caught up on what we've seen, she said, telling on herself. I'm a person who goes around and tells people, forget if you've never seen it before, blaze a new trail. Some of her colleagues, hoping to be assigned to the trial, went as far as rebranding themselves. This guy got some plugs in his hair, she said in a whisper from behind her district office desk one spring afternoon. I'm not going to say who it was, but I'm like, what is happening? People bought new clothes and everything. Reporters and other members pressed her, are you going to put in? And I'm like, no way. Then her office got a call. Pelosi wanted her on the team. When planning sessions began, Demings assumed Representative Adam Schiff, the lead manager, would give her, as the only non-lawyer in the room, controlled assignments that wouldn't require ad-libbing. But honey, Adam Schiff was like, okay, you have this section, you have this section, she said, slamming her palms on her office desk, shuffling papers, and you got a presentation and questions and answers. Schiff, now a member of the January 6th panel, had long been impressed by Demings' arresting presence and thoughtfulness from watching her on the Intelligence Committee he chairs. That gave him great confidence in her ability to communicate difficult to complex material and do so in a way that would be clear to the listener, he told me. He called her a bipartisan legislator. someone who I'm sure my Republican friends won't say it during her Senate campaign, but respected by people on both sides of the aisle. She also brought a unique perspective to the group, he said, that allowed her to speak with a certain moral clarity without it being preachy. She has that life experience that allows her to talk about things of great moral importance and do so in a way that immediately commands respect. Once the curtains went up on Trump's first impeachment and her national prominence rose, the trolls came out in droves. They phoned to threaten her. They emailed to call her ugly and comment on her hair. Because that's what you do with women, right? She said, oh, she's doing a really good job, so let me go to, you better put that chicken down, Val, because that suit looking a little tight today. But I was so laser-focused, and I'm so used to it. I've been called the names. Y'all better come with something else. Despite the haters, she served with calm focus and sharply questioned witnesses, breaking down Trump's misdeeds pointedly. The evidence was overwhelming that the president engaged in wrongdoing, she said. Now holding him accountable, that was the senator's job to do that. They chose not to. On tougher days, she leaned on her Christian faith to get through. Most echoing in her mind was, did I come to Congress for this purpose? Purpose especially resonates with Demings. Each year during Lent, she rereads Rick Warren's The Purpose-Driven Life. The 40-day devotional teaches that though life is transient, purpose endures in the task we fulfill. I'm just the vessel, Demings reminded herself during the trial, the instrument to carry the assignment through to completion. Next photo, in good company, Demings and her husband Jerry, now mayor of Orange County, rose through the ranks of the Orlando police force together. Biden called Demings to tell her he was running for office before his April 2019 announcement. Once his campaign launched and Demings became a cemented star in her party following the trial, the vetting team phoned to say she was on the vice presidential shortlist. To many, she was the perfect pick. Biden had been taunted by Trump for being soft on crime, and he faced pressure from Dems to add a woman of color to the ticket. Others thought Demings wasn't ready for national office. She was only on her second term, and while the impeachment role heightened her status, there were other glaring issues given the timing. Calls to defund the police had seen a revival with the 2020 callous killing of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd. Demings became both a symbol of common sense policing. She penned an op-ed in the Washington Post titled, My Fellow Brothers and Sisters in Blue, What the Hell Are You Doing? And a reflection of what the black community, whom Biden desperately counted on to win, saw as a problem. Law enforcement. She had been in the upper echelon of that very institution marked as patriarchal and racist. Crime dropped considerably during her tenure as chief, but critics called her a status quo leader, and some officers under her watch were accused of aggressive behavior. In one instance, a federal jury found an officer to have used excessive force against an 84-year-old veteran, awarding the man close to $1 million. Demings typically sided with her officers, but she later called for a review of the department's policy and enacted changes, like ensuring two officers rather than one responded to disturbance calls. The vetting team dug deep into Demings, her husband, their three sons, the couple's 20-year tax records, and anyone within a stone's throw throughout Demings' life. Three of her brothers were asked to explain their career choices. The team raised an eyebrow at another brother who had been arrested. Her sons handed over social media passwords and were asked about the intentions behind posts from years earlier. They asked about particular sermons her pastor preached. When the Demingses couldn't locate 2 years of their tax returns, the vetting team pushed the couple, Well, we need the other two, and perhaps you need to hire a CPA to help you get access to them. So they did. You know what I really wanted to say was, okay, when Donald Trump gives you 1 year of his never-tendered tax returns, then come back to me, she said, laughing a serious laugh. In August 2020, Biden called to let Demings know she had not been selected. He chose Senator Kamala Harris instead. Demings told me her competitive side responded with, oh, darn. But as a consummate optimist, she moved right back into, I know that God has something else for me. She also made it clear to Biden and his team that she didn't want a position in the cabinet because there's work to be done in the House, and that's where I am until I go to the Senate. When California Governor Gavin Newsom later selected then-Secretary of State Alex Padilla to fill Harris's seat, making him the sixth active Hispanic senator, black women were erased from the Senate. 2 weeks after the unexpected prayer in Lake County, Demings sat mid-row at St. Mark AME Church in Orlando with Jerry, their twin sons, and their sons' partners, and four of five grandbabies. She makes the two-hour flight home from D.C. every week because Sundays are sacred, just as they were for her working-class parents, James and Eloise Butler, who raised their four sons and three daughters, Demings is the baby, in a two-room house in Mandarin, a rural part of Jacksonville, and attended two different churches each Sunday. Demings described their life as really poor. One brother, Gerald, called where they lived country. We actually lived back in the woods. But they never realized it because their parents worked tirelessly to provide in the newly desegregated South. James was a janitor, Eloise a housekeeper. They tried to create a sense of normalcy. They tell their kids to never let those people define you by their vicious words. You define yourself by your ability to work hard and belief in yourself and belief in God. And though they didn't finish high school, they sowed the importance of education and civic responsibility. They were so faithful to it, Demings thought it was illegal not to vote. They'd pay someone to drive them to the polls when their station wagon wouldn't start. Her parents couldn't afford to pay tuition when Demings went to college at Florida State University, the first in the Butler home to do so, so she took out loans, enrolled in federal work study with campus police, and picked up shifts at McDonald's, working four nights a week. After graduating, she considered law school but couldn't foot the bill. She moved back home and worked as a social worker for 18 months before joining the Orlando Police Academy in 1983. The sense of duty James and Eloise embodied, grinding to make their children's lives vastly better than theirs, has shaped how Demings governs. Her staffers get on her for security reasons, for speaking too often to strangers, or at times bringing them back to her Metro West district office to chat. She does it anyway. When she sees everyday folks, she remembers her parents living in poverty, but how many people walked by them like they weren't even there, she told me. She speaks to the janitors, the painters, the people pushing the carts in the halls of Congress, the cafeteria workers preparing food, everyone accustomed to being invisible. To help them understand, I see you. I know you're there. After that Sunday service at St. Mark, over brunch, Jerry recalled how they first met at FSU. He was a finance and accounting major, and Demings studied criminology, same as his twin brother. They would occasionally see one another through mutual friends. As he retold their love story, Demings poked her trout friskily, crinkling the corners of her eyes. Though they had known each other in college, that wasn't her version of when they really got friendly. It was 1984, and he was a know-it-all detective, and I was a hard-working patrol rookie, she said, playfully gazing him down. You mean you were a know-it-all rookie, Jerry protested. They laughed down their two-of-a-kind climb through the Orlando Police Department. Jerry became the first black chief at 39 in 1998. This made Demings ineligible for any promotion because of Florida's anti-nepotism law. So, in 2002, he retired early to become Orange County's Director of Public Safety, and in 2008, its first black sheriff. The 63-year-old now serves as the first black mayor of Orange County. Demings quickly rose to deputy chief within a year and was appointed chief in 2007. They were well on their way to becoming an Orlando power couple. All those years their parents spent risking their lives in uniform, the couple's three adult sons, twins Antoine and Antonio, and Austin, never worried about mom and dad not coming home. Though death or injury were a constant possibility, Demings said they chose to dedicate their lives to public service and knew the risk. But when they got home every night, we took the uniform off, and then it's like, what we gonna cook for dinner? We really tried to be just like any other family. January 6th changed all of that. The night before the mob of Trumpists tried to overthrow democracy, some House members texted one another in their group chat concerned. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special sub-channel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.